Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Election Day. It's Tuesday, November 2. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of this Gazette today, Albernette's growth leads to new school facilities. This story is by Grace King. Students in Albernette High School's industrial technology class are temporarily using the former fire station along Main Street as a workshop, while their new classroom is under construction. A new industrial technology classroom is just one of the projects underway in the Albernette Community School District, part of an $11.5 million bond issue passed by voters in March of 2020. "We are outgrowing our building," Superintendent Danny Trimble said. "We need modern facilities to match modern programming." Remodeled classrooms to the industrial technology program, Family and Consumer Science, Agriculture and Business programs in the main building, and a multi-purpose building with a full-size gym are expected to be completed by the summer of 2022. A small gymnasium in the main building is being remodeled into 8 more classrooms for much-needed classroom space. Eventually, 2 new music classrooms and an auditorium also will be completed. About 700 K-12 students attend the Albernette Community School District. The referendum required 60% approval from voters in the district on 2 ballot questions. The first was for the project itself. That was approved by 65.7% of the voters. The second ballot item was to allow the tax levy rate to exceed $2.70 per $1,000 of assessed taxable value, but not to exceed $4.05. That was passed by 64.3% of the voters. However, when the district went to bid for the projects in November 2020, the bids came in significantly above the architect's estimates, with prices skyrocketing because of the pandemic, Trimble said. The school board decided to authorize the use of the district's portion of an existing 1-cent sales tax for schools to add up to $2.7 million to the bond sales. Brett Waffup, industrial technology teacher, as well as football and wrestling coach, said the former shop classroom, now being upgraded, was dingy. "It wasn't a place that was overly inviting," he said. He hopes the new classroom attracts more students to the program. About 50 high school students are enrolled in an industrial technology class. "It's important to give kids the opportunities to see what options are out there," he said. "Over the last few years, we've had several students go into the trades and have been very successful and are loving what they're doing." Albernette music teachers also are excited about the opportunities the new facilities will provide their programs. Band and vocal music classes currently share the same space, making scheduling difficult since they can't have the classes at the same time. "It's time for the band to be able to have their stuff and space arranged as best suits them, and choir classes arranged as best suits us," said Joe Fegerston, 6th through 12th grade vocal music teacher. "Another challenge for the band is that the classroom is on a different floor than the gym where the band currently performs. We have to move all the chairs and instruments, some which don't fit on the elevators, down a flight of stairs," said Matt Ayler, 5th through 12th grade band teacher. "The new classroom will be across the hall from the new auditorium," Ayler said. "The auditorium also will create a better concert environment for the audience, more comfortable than bleachers could possibly be, and a better experience for students. I think all of us are just excited to have state-of-the-art facilities in addition to a performing space that's designed for that," Fegerston said. "The sound quality in an auditorium also will be better than it is in the gym. I'm excited for our community to be able to enjoy the music we're making. I think that will be one of the biggest highlights, and it's for our students and audience to hear the difference," Fegerston said. "Music is everywhere in life," Ayler said. "Having a greater understanding of music, being a competent musician, gives students more refinement in the way they think about music they choose to listen to and experience. Even if they never pick up their instrument again after high school, their relationship to music across the rest of their lives is forever changed for the better." Also on the front page today, UI Sports Gender Equity Deal Clears Hurdle. This by Vanessa Miller. The state agreed Monday to pay from its general fund nearly $400,000 to settle a lawsuit brought by University of Iowa female athletes who contended plans initially announced last year by the UI to cut women's swimming and diving was a Title IX gender equity violation. The state appeal board approved the settlement, including $307,545 in attorney's fees and $92,444.14 in other litigation costs, including expert witness expenses, after a federal judge in October found the totals reasonable, according to court documents. Nothing in the parties' submissions appears to be unreasonable, and the court notes the expert reports were thorough. U.S. District Court Judge Stephanie Rose wrote in her decision, noting sports and female athletics experts involved in the case, including Donna Lopiano, president of Sports Management Resources, cost as much as $500 an hour for testimony, $650 an hour for consultation, or $425 an hour for work on a report. Dr. Lopiano's testimony in particular was very helpful, Rose ruled. Despite UI objections and denials, Lopiano asserted in her expert report that UI athletics since 2003 had failed to meet Title IX's Prong 1 participation requirement, providing male and female athletes with athletics participation opportunities proportional to the percent of males and females in the undergraduate student population. After going to great length in her report to spell out ways in which institutions could comply with that requirement, Lopiano testified the UI was required to meet Title IX's actual proportionality standard and failed. It is clear that in every year for 18 years, the gaps exceeded the allowable prong one variance, Lopiano wrote. I further opine that these gaps are substantially larger than depicted. The participation data is so questionable that it should not have been relied upon to annually assure the government that it was in compliance with Title IX. In addition to expenses, the UI settlement includes a list of conditions. UI athletics must keep women swimming and diving for at least 7 years, despite the earlier plans to drop it to help save money in light of the pandemic budget losses. It must add a women's wrestling team, hiring a coach no later than spring 2022, and recruiting athletes to start competing in the 2023-24 school year. The team should have about 30 wrestlers, allocate the maximum allowed scholarships, and make reasonable efforts to promote the sport and persuade other D1 schools to add women's wrestling for a competitive schedule. UI Athletics must maintain a 3-year rolling cap of 75 female opportunities on its rowing team, which the lawsuit alleged had been inflated to meet Title IX requirements. The UI must appoint an independent Title IX compliance monitor and post Title IX reports on the UI Athletics website annually. UI Athletics Director Gary Barta, in announcing the new women's wrestling team, conceded the settlement is behind its timing now, as the department still is fiscally strapped and not in an ideal position to launch a new program. In talking with the Gazette after the settlement, Lopiano said that forced or not, taking this step, being probably one of the most visible wrestling schools in the country, this is really important for them to do it. The UI was compelled to settle after an earlier court opinion stated women were likely to succeed with their lawsuit, Lopiano said. She surmised the university thought, we don't want to waste this money in court. We don't want this reputation. Kudos to the new president for making sure they did the right thing, Lopiano said, of new UI president Barbara Wilson, who started her job as president over the summer. The settlement shouldn't end the pressure, though, Lopiano said, noting the program has a lot of work to do to make women's wrestling successful and to meet federal gender equity mandates. Think about the effort he puts into men's wrestling, she said of Barta. If you want your daughter to be treated the same as your son, what does that mean? and that should be a no-brainer for him in terms of what is the blueprint. During Monday's appeal board discussion, Jeffrey Thompson, Solicitor General in the Iowa Attorney General's office, said the judgment closes out the dispute. The addition of women's wrestling adds participation opportunities for women at the University of Iowa, and in everybody's opinion, brought the Title IX calculation back into balance, he said. The fees paid by the state are, in my opinion, much lower than we would have ended up paying had we continued to litigate the case. The state appeal board also approved spending $250,000 to settle a malpractice case out of the UI hospitals and clinics involving a patient who underwent a vein-related surgery on his leg. An order for blood thinners was deleted by mistake, according to the settlement, resulting in clots and additional surgery. The state board also approved a $75,000 deal with a UI student who injured a knee while walking into Catlett Residence Hall in August 2019. She tripped on a wrinkle in the floor mat, causing her to fall. After the student suffered significant injuries, she was prevented from securing employment and from enjoying those activities typical of a college freshman. In a brief article above the fold, how to vote in today's local elections. Voters have a final opportunity today to cast their ballots in Iowa's city and school board elections. At stake in the corridor, who serves on city councils and school boards, whether Linn County communities can keep paying for infrastructure with a sales tax, if the door remains open to apply again for a Cedar Rapids casino, and the fate of other local ballot questions. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Today's forecast is mostly sunny with highs in the mid-40s. Voters must show an approved identification, such as a driver's license, voter ID card, passport, or military ID. Find your precinct and see sample ballots through your county auditor. In Linn County, linncountyelections.org. In Johnson County, johnsoncountyiowa.gov/auditor. If you planned to vote absentee but haven't sent in your ballot, surrender it to the poll workers at your polling place. They will call the auditor's office to void out your absentee request. You will then vote by regular ballot. To register at the polls, individuals may do so with an ID and potentially proof of address. Details are at sos.iowa.gov. Learn about the candidates and issues on the ballot and follow the results at thegazette.com/campaigns-elections. Lastly, on the front page, state fines AgriStar after blast injures two workers. This story is by Aaron Jordan. Iowa regulators have fined AgriStar Meat and Poultry Plant in Postville $28,415 for safety violations found after a February explosion injured two employees. The state cited AgriStar for four serious violations leading to the February 15 explosion in the dock area of the kosher meat processing plant. The largest fine, $11,366, was for not maintaining safe surfaces for walking and operating vehicles, according to citations the Gazette obtained from Iowa OSHA. Inspectors found the dock floor was covered with ice, dirt, bird feathers, water, and manure, which caused an employee operating a powered industrial truck, like a forklift, on February 15 to back into a propane cylinder, puncturing it and releasing gas, which caused the explosion. The blast hit two men working nearby, causing burns on one worker's face and injuring the other. The plant temporarily lost power, and the explosion damaged the dock roof and walls. Unrelated to the explosion, the floor debris caused an AgriStar employee to slip and fall, injuring his back on February 9. Iowa OSHA also cited AgriStar for not evaluating powered industrial truck operators' performance at least every 3 years and failing to certify training and evaluation of those operators. The last violation, says AgriStar, failed to train operators to slow down on slippery or wet floors. Employee was operating a powered industrial truck, unloading live poultry in cages, the citation notes. The condition of the floor was known to be wet and covered in feathers, bird feces, and sawdust, yet the employer did not take action to offset the conditions. AgriStar has paid the penalties in this case, Iowa OSHA reported. AgriStar opened in 2009 at the site of the former AgriProcessors, Inc. Canadian business owner Hershey Friedman bought the plant and invested $7.5 million to modernize and upgrade before reopening. The Gazette reported in 2010, 2 years after a massive immigration raid at AgriProcessors. Friedman told Forward.com in 2016, the facility has processed about 50,000 birds a day, primarily chickens. He said the plant can slaughter 400 cattle in a day, but often processed fewer because it was looking for quality beef from within a 100-mile radius of the plant. Friedman said AgriStar also was using the government's E-Verify program to make sure employees have legal immigration status, Forward.com reported. Turning now to the Iowa Today page, this story by the Gazette, a body found at a Cedar Rapids construction site. Workers at a southwest Cedar Rapids construction site reported to police Monday morning they had discovered a body. Authorities said that at 8:42 a.m., workers in the area of 64th Avenue and Edgewood Road Southwest contacted dispatchers to report a person down. Officers arrived to find the body of a male. Police, who did not release an approximate age of the person, said they were withholding the individual's identity until relatives could be notified. The body will be transported to the state medical examiner's office in Ankeny for an autopsy. Police said they don't believe there's a risk to the public because of the death. And feds are reviewing seclusion practices at 10 Cedar Rapids schools. This story by Grace King. The Department of Justice is conducting on-site visits this week of 10 Cedar Rapids schools as part of an ongoing review of the district's policies, procedures, and practices relating to the use of physical restraint and seclusion. The Department of Justice has not filed any complaint or made any findings against the district, Superintendent Noreen Bush said in an email. The district is collaborating and fully cooperating with the department's request and welcomes the opportunity to continue to improve our practices to support our students, Bush said. The Department of Justice is visiting the following schools: Arthur Elementary, Grant Wood Elementary, Harrison Connections, Jefferson High, Johnston STEAM Academy, Pierce Elementary, Polk Alternative Education Center, Taylor Elementary, Viola Gibson Elementary, and Wilson Middle School. Seclusion rooms are used in many Iowa school districts as a last resort if students are at risk of harming themselves or others. An investigation into the use of seclusion rooms in Cedar Rapids schools was launched in 2017 after a complaint was made on behalf of a student at Pierce Elementary. The student was held in a seclusion room because she wouldn't stop crying, a violation of state seclusion rules. Cedar Rapids Elementary School students were held in seclusion rooms or physically restrained 237 times in the first month of the 2019-20 school year. The Gazette reported in 2020 this was more than 10 times a day and more than 4 times as much as in the first month of the 2015-16 school year. At the time, the district did not disclose information showing why students were secluded or restrained. In other Iowa Today news, a shooting outside the Elks Lodge kills one from Ames. Ames police on Monday identified the man who was fatally shot outside the Elks Lodge on Friday night. Stashawn D.L. Brown, age 23, of Des Moines, was transported to Mary Greeley Medical Center early Saturday, where he later died of his injuries. Shortly before midnight Friday, police responded to reports of shots fired near a crowd of almost 100 people in the 500 block of Douglas Avenue, according to the news release from the department. Police believe that a fight escalated into the shooting. Commander Jason Tuttle previously told the Des Moines Register, and that multiple people fired their guns. By the time police arrived, some people had fled the scene. Tuttle said there were no other reported injuries and no arrest had been made as of Monday. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest column is contributed today by Pam Jokum and Joe Bolcom. And the title is U.S. Bucks Boost Iowa Budget. In Iowa, the nice thing to do is to give people credit for a job well done. John Hendrickson, policy director for a Republican-leaning foundation, seems to have forgotten that lesson. And that's from Conservative Budgeting Works in Iowa, October 25, printed in the Gazette, with his opinions about Iowa's budget situation. The truth is that Iowa's economy is in much better position because of the hard work of President Joe Biden and U.S. Representative Cindy Axne. Federal COVID-19 relief funds injected into our economy have helped Iowans and helped move our economy forward. Truth in Accounting, which has recently released its Financial State of the State's 2021 report, ranks Iowa in the top 10 of fiscally stable states. The Truth in Accounting report clearly states that the positive ranking is due largely to federal funds. Iowa's overall financial condition improved by almost 25%, largely due to COVID-related grants, which equaled the state's reported surplus, $2 billion. President Biden and congressional Democrats provided much-needed help to Iowa families and businesses, more than $9 billion, through the American Rescue Plan and by leading the fight against the pandemic. Governor Kim Reynolds has made it abundantly clear that she wasn't happy with the American Rescue Plan's pandemic relief legislation, but she happily takes credit for the federal dollars that are used in much-needed investments in Iowa. It's been announced that federal dollars are being invested into programs that the governor and Republican legislators have neglected for years. Federal investments include $200 million for much-needed broadband investment in Iowa, $100 million for investment in affordable housing needed across the state, something that has been needed a long time, and $300 million in investment in manufacturing workforce shortage. Our workforce shortage has been the number one issue for employers in Iowa for years. All these investments are made possible because of the American Rescue Plan. These dollars help build back better. So let's say a big thank you to President Biden and Representative Axne for helping our state get back on its feet. State Senator Pam Jokum is a Democrat from Dubuque, and Joe Bolcom is a Democrat from Iowa City. Adam Sullivan's At Liberty column today, what will we do after the election? Election Day marks the end of the contentious 2021 election session for Iowa school boards and city councils. Wednesday, most of us will go back to not caring about local government. Iowa set voter turnout records in the 2018 midterm and the 2020 general election. Early signs ahead of today's contests, an influx of candidates on the ballot, and high participation in early voting suggest it could be a record setter for local elections. Even with a shorter early voting period, down from 29 days to 20 days under a GOP election reform bill passed this year, Linn County and Johnson County have already topped their absentee ballot figures from 2019, the first time Iowa held combined city and school elections. Linn County had received nearly 9,000 ballots as of Monday morning, up from 4,702 in the whole 2019 election. The high turnout coincides with local candidates adopting messages, tactics, and fundraising lists from the national political scene. They're taking our political and cultural dividing lines and mapping them into local politics. In Cedar Rapids, there's a four-way race for mayor, featuring an incumbent and two well-funded challengers. Three candidates reported raising almost $400,000 combined. The top fundraiser in the race got only about a third of her funds from Iowa donors. There is particularly high interest in school races, apparently a response to schools' COVID-19 policies and debates over teaching about racism and other historic injustices in school. There are fewer seats up for grabs than in 2019, but more candidates on the ballot, according to figures from the Iowa Association of School Boards. The number of candidates per seat is up to 1.83 from 1.28 2 years ago. Much has been said about the role of partisanship in Iowa's local races this year. Trump supporters are running slates of school board challengers, while local Democratic Party apparatuses are actively backing city and school candidates. Both sides have some winning candidates in today's elections. Once they're in office, they will probably discover governing isn't as much fun as pretending to be a partisan politician on a campaign trail. The perverse glamour of spouting off about politically charged national issues will fade into the mundanity of work sessions and budget presentations. Political factions like the ones involved in these elections are good at supporting candidates. They're not good at holding them accountable. Once your guy is in office, you probably won't check in to make sure he's holding true to the values he espoused as a candidate. That's especially true if your whole identity is wrapped up in your political affiliation. Americans have a backward view of the democratic process. We put a lot of emphasis on voting, even to the point of ridiculing those who don't participate. But almost nobody cares about the real work of representative government that happens between elections, following the issues, and putting pressure on politicians to do the right thing, even if they're your guy. So, be careful who you make bedfellows out of. They might still be there the morning after the election. And that's Adam Sullivan at Liberty. One community letter to the day, community letter for today, is critical race theory taught in Iowa schools? In school board election campaigns across the state, we've been hearing talk about the teaching of critical race theory in Iowa's K through 12 schools. Let's step back to look at this issue more clearly. CRT, critical race theory, was developed in the mid-1970s as an elective course in graduate schools and law schools, as legal scholars studied why racial inequality persisted even after the groundbreaking civil rights laws of the 60s. It is an analytical framework for exploring why racial inequality persists despite laws that promise equal protection. Critical race theory is not being taught in K-12 schools, whose students do not have the academic background in law and economics that would allow them to study it. It is important to be aware that when people talk about their concern about CRT being taught in schools, they are actually expressing their fears about curriculum that addresses the realities of race and racism and efforts to support student diversity, inclusion, and equity. Nothing more and nothing less. And that letter's signed by David Dewar from Iowa City. And there is one more letter. Will new hospital project spawn cost overruns? I have one question for those eager to approve the University of Iowa's new hospital in North Liberty. How much cost overrun should we anticipate this time? The UI Stead Family Children's Hospital was bid at $271 million in 2018. 3 years later, it has cost $407 million and counting. Who's really paying for this abysmal planning? And that is signed by Mary Kemen from Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, November 2, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to the obituary page in other notices. First from Delhi, Patsy J. Rounds, 87, of Wellsburg, formerly of Delhi, died Saturday, October 30th. Bowen Camp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Manchester, is in charge. In Dyersville, Luke D. Wallers, age 59, died Thursday, October 28. Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. In Olwine, Missy A. Iseton Klink Sladen, 56, died Saturday, October 30th, Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home, Olwine. And in Oshin, Joan Lovell, age 79, of Blue Mounds, Wisconsin, formerly of Oshin, died Friday, October 8. Schmidt's Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Aachen is in charge. Moving now to the regular notices, first from Cedar Rapids, Therese Marie Benzer passed away suddenly at age 64, Thursday, October 28, at Mercy Hospital, after having been diagnosed with a heart condition. She passed away quietly with her husband, Gary Benzer, at her bedside. The visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, November 4, and a memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, November 5, both in the chapel at First Congregational Church, 361 17th Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids. Interment will follow at noon at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of Tranquility. In Amana, Gerd Bell, age 89, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, October 30, at Amana. A visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, November 7, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will take place at 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 8, at St. Paul's United Methodist Church in Cedar Rapids. Burial will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids for Gerd Bell. In Williamsburg, Dorothy Ann Higgins Schwartz, born April 5, 1924, passed away peacefully at Mercy Hospital Friday, October 29, at the age of 97. She graduated from Calamus High School in 1942 and taught in a one-room school for 5 years. A celebration of life services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, November 6, at the St. Paul Lutheran Church in Williamsburg. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday at Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. Burial will be at 2 p.m. in the Buena Vista Cemetery in Calamus. A memorial fund has been established for Systems Unlimited Group Home, Rural Employment Opportunities, or St. Paul Lutheran Church. Powell Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. In Cedar Rapids, Dorothy Marie Bolt, age 92, formerly of LaPorte City, died Saturday, October 30th at Unity Point Health St. Luke's in Cedar Rapids. Born June 9, 1929 at Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 4 at St. Paul United Methodist with burial in the Westview Cemetery, both in LaPorte City. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at LaPorte City Funeral Home and also 1 hour before the service at the church. The service will be recorded and posted to the funeral home website. The family requests that all those who attend the visitation and service please wear a mask. Memorials may be directed to St. Paul United Methodist Church, Hawkins Memorial Library, or Unity Point Hospice. LaPorte City Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Cedar Rapids, June Louise Carbnock, age 94, died Saturday, October 30th at Hiawatha Care Center, surrounded by her family. Visitation will be from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Thursday, November 4 at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A private burial will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Also in Cedar Rapids, Stephanie Dietz, age 30, passed away Saturday, October 30, at her home. Graveside service will be at noon Wednesday, November 3, at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Arrangements are by the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to the family by way of the Donate Now link on Stephanie's tribute wall, where you may also share support and condolences at www.stuartbaxter.com. In Cedar Rapids, Mary Franta, age 84, passed away Friday, October 29, at Mercy Medical Center. Services are at 10 a.m. Friday, November 4, at Trinity St. James United Methodist in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, November 4, at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories Stateroom. Burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Marion, Gregory O. Hapgood Sr., age 83, passed away at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids on Sunday, October 31, after a long illness. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, November 4 at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, 3855 Katz Drive, Marion. Funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 5 at First Presbyterian Church, 802 12th Street in Marion. A private family burial will be held at a future date. From Fairfax, Melva Ann Jacobek, age 90, or Jacobek, age 90, of Fairfax slipped away suddenly Tuesday, October 26th, surrounded by her beloved family. A private family gathering will be held at a later date. Tien Funeral Home is serving the family. In Tipton, Kent Penningroth, 62, of Napomo, California, formerly of Tipton, passed away October 29 from complications of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Funeral services will be held at 4 p.m. Wednesday, November 3, at St. John's Lutheran Church in Arroyo Grande, California, and at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, November 6, at Red Oak Grove Church near Tipton, Iowa, with Pastor Tim Starnes officiating. Burial will follow in Red Oak Grove Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Stephen Edward Jones, age 64, passed away Sunday, October 31st. Iowa Cremation in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Marion, Jennifer, known as Jenny Hebert, age 46, passed away Saturday, October 30th. Funeral services are at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 4, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. Burial will be private for the family at Pleasant Valley Cemetery, rural Holland, Iowa. In Swisher, Martha Louise Zach, age 98 of Swisher, died Thursday, October 28 at her home. Celebration of Life services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, November 5 at First Presbyterian Church near Ely, with the Reverend Dr. Julie Schutt presiding. Burial will be in DuPont Cemetery near Swisher. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to services Friday at the church. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is in charge of arrangements. From Kelowna, Patsy Britton, age 73, died Saturday, October 30 at her home. Funeral services have been set for 11 a.m. Saturday, November 6th at Petersheim Funeral Home in Kelowna. Burial will be at Sharon Hill Cemetery. Visitation will be 2 hours prior to the service at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, the family would like you to donate in the name of Patsy Britton to stjude.org. Notifications of donations can be sent to the Britton family, 1025 Larch Avenue in Kelowna. And lastly, from North English, Emery Glenn Cobb, age 96, passed away October 30th at his home in North English, surrounded by family. Graveside service will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, November 7 at the North English Cemetery with military rites. A reception with light refreshments will follow at the History Center. Moving to the sports page, lots of volleyball action, so I'll be reading some abbreviated columns in order to get more information in. From the front page of the sports section, Marion. Tops Xavier in a 5-set thriller. This story by Jeff Linder. As the match wandered toward a 5th set, Roxanne Paulson wasn't the only vocal one in the Marion huddle. As Paulson talked strategy, several of the Wolves screamed incentive, "We're not done. We're not done." And they're not done. The 5th-ranked Wolves led the final set from start to finish and outlasted number 4 Cedar Rapids Xavier 25-27, 25-13, 15-25, 25-19, 15-9 in the Class 4A quarterfinal at the state volleyball tournament last night at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse. "It's just belief," senior Elise Mafke said. "We've been preparing. We've played them multiple times." They'll face number 1 Western Dubuque 32-3 in a semifinal at noon on Wednesday. And Johnston outlasts number one Liberty in a 5A stunner, this also by Jeff Linder. The Butterflies never really went away, and neither did the Dragons. 10th-ranked Johnston overcame two match points in the fourth set, erased a 12-10 deficit in the fifth, and shocked number one Iowa City Liberty 25-21, 17-25, 17-25, 26-24, 16-14 in a Class 5A quarterfinal at the state volleyball tournament Monday afternoon. I still haven't processed it yet, senior Dasha Svitashev said. There was a lot of screaming in the locker room. I couldn't hear anything. Johnston, at 28-11, is making its first state appearance in 6 years. It won't be a one-and-done. Instead, the Dragons will face number four, Cedar Falls, in a semifinal at 10 a.m. Wednesday. And in Class 5A, Ankeny keeps rowing the boat to victory. David Wims evoked the words of University of Minnesota football coach P.J. Fleck. After Wims saw his Ankeny team fall behind CIML rival Urbandale 2-1 in Monday's Class 5A state quarterfinal match, he had this message between sets 3 and 4. "Hey, I talked to them about rowing the boat," he said. "I told them they just had to keep rowing, keep going, and things will turn around. We knew everything Urbandale was going to do when they get the ball. We read it, we get in position, and we dig it." The defending champions responded. They built sizable leads in each of the final two sets and then had to hold off late charges from the Jayhawks. It resulted in a 25-23, 23-25, 14-25, 23-25, 15-12 victory. Number 3 Ankeny at 40-5 will meet number 2 Pleasant Valley in a 10 a.m. semifinal on Wednesday. Urbandale, which split two regular season matches with the Hawks, retires at 33-9. Turning now to the Business 380 page, this story from the Gazette: Midwest won to acquire Iowa First Bank shares. The combined company will hold $6.2 billion in assets. Iowa City-based Midwest One Financial Group said Monday it plans to acquire Iowa First Bank shares of Muscatine in a deal valued at approximately $47.6 million. The combined company will have approximately $6.2 billion in total assets, with more than 60 banking offices throughout Iowa, as well as Minnesota, Wisconsin, Florida, and Colorado. This is a natural extension of the Midwest One geographic footprint as we increase our market presence in Muscatine and Jefferson counties, Midwest One CEO Charles Funk said. Both First National Banks, Muscatine and Fairfield, have been longtime pillars in their respective communities. Each has a strong deposit franchise and a long history of service in their markets. Midwest One, as of September 30, had total assets of approximately $5.9 billion, operating 34 banking offices in Iowa and 22 elsewhere. Iowa First Bank Shares operates 5 banking offices in Iowa throughout its 2 banks, First National Bank of Muscatine and First National Bank in Fairfield. First National Bank of Muscatine on September 30 had approximately $361.6 million in total assets, with $315.9 million in deposits and $203.9 million in total loans. First National Bank in Fairfield had approximately $157.6 million in total assets, with $137.4 million in deposits and $100 million in total loans. The acquisition is expected to close during the first quarter of 2022 and is subject to approval by Iowa First Bankshares shareholders and regulatory agencies, as well as other customary closing conditions. Turning now to the community page, here are some Eastern Iowa briefs of interest. From Cedar Rapids, Waypoint starts Caring Dads program to support fathers. Waypoints has announced a new initiative called the Caring Dads program, which will be added to the multitude of services provided by the domestic violence program. The Caring Dads program aims to help fathers improve their relationships with their children and end controlling, abusive, and neglective behavior. The program is a 17-week support group that will offer men opportunities to connect with other fathers and learn about themselves and their parenting through group discussions, exercises, and homework. Anyone interested in joining the group can contact Alexis Chadwick, Caring Dads Program Coordinator, at 319-550-0248. The group is funded by Lynn County Decategorization. In Iowa City, sign up for November 10 cholesterol screening at the Senior Center. The Visiting Nurse Association will conduct the screening from 8:30 to 10:30, November 10, at the Iowa City Johnson County Senior Center, 28 South Lynn Street in Iowa City. Appointments are required. Call 319-337-9686, extension 1155 for more information or to schedule an appointment. A general risk assessment, blood pressure, and cholesterol screening will be available. A lipid profile with glucose will be offered for $17. To obtain the most accurate results, a 10 to 12 hour fast, which means no eating or drinking anything but water, is recommended. All attendees are required to wear a face mask and will be screened before their appointment. In Dyersville, the National Farm Toy Show and Auction is this weekend. The 44th annual National Farm Toy Show and Auction is held Friday through Sunday in Dyersville, featuring more than 200 exhibitors from 20 states. A bus will provide shuttle service for the different event sites. Beckman High School, the National Farm Toy Museum, two outdoor sales areas east of the museum, and the Commercial Club Park area. Park at one event site and shuttle to the others. General admission is $10 a day, with children 12 and under free when accompanied by an adult. A three-day pass with special early access is $30. For more information or hours, vendor listings, and maps, call 800-533-8293 or visit www.toyfarmer.com. And in some things to do today, in the museum category, York Rite Freemasonry. The story continues. This exhibit shows the history of the York Rite, one of the appendant bodies of the Freemasonry, using regalia photographs and documents from the collection of the Grand Lodge of Iowa. Visitors will be able to trace the history of the Royal Arch, the cryptic rite, and the Knights Templar from the late 18th century to present. That's from 10 to 4 p.m. at the Iowa Masonic Library and Museum in Cedar Rapids. It's free. And in other area interest, Trivia Night, Weird But True. This online trivia quiz game presented by the Cedar Rapids Public Library is filled with weird, obscure, random, and sometimes useless facts. It's a Facebook event, so follow the library on Facebook. Mark going to the event to be notified when the link goes live. It's from 6 to 7:30 p.m. online. The cost is free, and it's open to all ages. And in the hobby area, write your memoir program. Have you ever wanted to write your own memoir? Learn how to get started, as well as how to pick a theme. The program will be led by local writer Cynthia Peterson. Bring a notebook or journal to the Hiawatha Public Library from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. That's free and open to all ages. And this story by Elijah Desius, Planting Solutions. Iowa City Girl Scout receives a gold award for a community orchard. An Iowa City West High School graduate has received the highest award in Girl Scouts for creating a community partner powered orchard dedicated to providing fresh fruit for those in need. Heidi Schmidt Rundell, an Iowa City native who is now a freshman at the University of Northern Iowa, has ensured that food insecure people receiving assistance from local pantries won't just get canned or frozen goods. With six fruit trees planted at St. Andrews Presbyterian in Iowa City, she has staggered the orchard's harvests from August to November, making fruit more accessible throughout the year. I noticed that having good, nutritious food wasn't always available for everyone in the community, she said. The goal of the project was to get more fresh fruit available in the community to those who don't have access. With four types of apples and two types of cherries, the orchard has been organized to have a life of its own, even with its creator no longer there. Thanks to community volunteers, Orchard for All will continue to be self-sufficient, donating most fruit to local food pantries and using some for pies and jams to raise funds for the orchard. Over the last 4 years, Schmidt Rundle, age 18, spent 170 hours on the project, twice the time required to earn the gold award, by leading a team of volunteers to clear an area for it, installing a walkway and fencing and planting the trees. To continue to recruit volunteers, she created a slideshow that will teach them how to care for the orchard. The student learned more about food insecurity in the course of earning her silver award, for which she helped gather supply donations to the shelter house. The idea was sparked by a program at her church that donated vegetables to those in need from a nearby garden. "I called the shelter house and asked if they needed fruit," she said. Using their preferences, she chose Honeycrisp, Gala, Fuji, and Granny Smith apples. For cherries, she elected Tart Star and Sweet Stella. Using a $1,000 grant from Toyota and many in-kind donations, she was able to start the orchard and put $200 into an account for future needs. Along the way, the pandemic presented challenges to recruiting volunteers without the group presentations that she planned to rely on. Instead, she pivoted to recruiting virtually as much as possible. When she met resistance with church members about having the orchard close to their garden, her knowledge base advisor, Lizanne Bollinger, said Schmidt Rundle refused to make the project small or concede. "People put some roadblocks up," Bollinger said. She found a way to do it. Bollinger, who has a background in science, helped guide her in writing grants and finding money to fund the project as it was designed. "Heidi's one of those people who has great ideas, but often they're too big," she said. "We had to figure out how to pare it down to something you could accomplish." Unlike an Eagle Scout project, Girl Scout projects earning the Gold Award must have a sustainable life of their own beyond the project's end. The project must create sustainable change on a community or world issue by addressing the root cause of a problem, planning a solution, and implementing it with a team they lead to drive change. "It's still kind of wild to realize this is something I put together," she said. "I'm excited to see how this organization blooms and how the orchard blooms 10 years down the road." We'll finish up with a weather note. Cedar Rapids looking for a high of 45 and a low of 24 today. The normal is 56 for a high and low of 37. The record high of 77 for today was set in 1938. The record low of 10 degrees was set in 1966. And we're snowless so far. We've already turned the calendar on the final month of meteorological fall and have yet to receive snow in Cedar Rapids. This actually isn't crazy. The mean first date for a trace or more is November 18 over the period of record for the city. However, this is the first time since 2018 making it this far into the season without any snow. November usually has between 3 or 4 days where at least a trace is recorded in Cedar Rapids. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, November 2. Please remember to vote. I'm your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.